Sonia, the Macbeth as it happens.
Michel Fer is a philosopher, founding editor of Zone Books, and president of Set Francelat, a French organization that issues an annual publication monitoring France's immigration policy under Nicolas Sarkozy's government. He is the author of Powerless by Design, The Age of the International Community, and co-editor of Non-Governmental Politics with Gaël Krikorian and Yates McKee. Sonia talks to Michel Fer about the failure of neoliberal policies and about citizen activism as a possible alternative to the tyranny of markets. He also talks us through some of his key experiences in publishing. Neoliberalism versus liberalism.
My claim is that the representation of the human condition, the representation of what people are, what makes them tick, how do they act and how do they react, is very different in the neoliberal times than in the liberal time. And this has philosophical and historical implication, but it also has political implication in the sense that it seems to me that one of the big problems of the left today is that it tends to reduce neoliberalism to a radical form of liberalism and doesn't emphasize enough the changes. And there's always a problem when what you fight is yesterday's war, because you have very little chance of winning if you're beating on a dead horse, in the sense that you're attacking people that died about 50 years ago instead of attacking your current enemies.
Each period has its own market.
There's always a chance, but first, in order to have a chance, you have to understand what you're dealing with. And it seems to me that what the left has not come to really assess well is the fact that to each period, there seems to be a pertinent market. In the golden age of liberalism, the market of reference was the market of goods and services. In the welfare times, the market of reference was the labor market. And the labor market, which where you had this opposition between the bosses, the owners of capital on one hand, the unions and the representative of work on the other, and you had some kind of arbitration between the two. Today, in neoliberalism, and that's very banal to say, the market of reference is the financial market. But from that banal point, one should draw very important consequences, which is the fact that financial markets don't work in the same way as the labor market or as the goods and service market. And most importantly, there is no such thing as a law of supply and demand leading to equilibrium on financial market. What is remarkable about financial market, what is remarkable about assets on financial market, is that when the price of a stock goes up, the demand goes up, which is totally contrary to what liberal economists believe, which means that, in fact, booms and busts are not maladies or accidents that happen to financial markets, but it's their normal behavior. And one has to take stock of that fact in order to change things.
Financial markets, a matter of credit and reputation.
This market doesn't work in the same way. This market works in a way where the value of a bond or the value of a stock, the value of an asset, is predicated on how people in the market think it's going to evolve in the next 6 months. So it's not about profit and profitability. It's about credit and reputation. And that's how this market works. That's the first point.
Invade the markets for a redistribution of credit.
The second point is to remember the struggles of the past. How did the labor movement start in the 19th century? What the liberals had done was to construct the labor market as if it were modeled on the goods and service market. What liberals said was that we're all owners. We all own something. Of course, some of us own capital. Others only own their labor force. But we're all owners who go to the market trying to sell what we own at the best possible price. And of course, the Marxist critique was to say this is false, right? I mean, this is how exploitation, this is a formal equality that hides and reveals. However, The fact that they denounced it didn't make them say, well, we should go back to craftsmanship and refuse this kind of representation. On the contrary, unions were based on what? On people saying, well, yes, okay, let's pretend it's true. Let's admit that we are owners of our labor force and we're trying to sell it at the best price on the market. Well, what is the best possible way of selling it at the best price on the market? By making a union, by organizing and going together on the market to try to sell our labor force and to sort of raise the price by the strengths of our collective. In other words, what the labor movement did is that they didn't say we have to accept the law of the market, and they didn't say we have to refuse the existence of the market. What they did was they went on the market and trying to change things from then. And I think that's what we should do today. In other words, the idea is neither, as the right says, and as unfortunately the social democrats are saying, well, we have to accept the laws of the financial market because that's the way the world is. But we can't say, like the radical left is saying, what we have to do is either destroy these markets or refuse it, renounce it. I think the proper way to respond is to go on these markets and change the condition under which credit is attributed.
Don't forget, we're your bosses.
And I think that is one of the implicit demands of the Indignados movement. What they're saying is that stop saying that in times of crisis, we need government that protect us. That's not what we need. We don't need protection from the government. It's not us who need the government. It's you, the government, who need us. Because how do things work? Governments today have, in fact, two kinds of bosses. And that was one, I think, especially in Barcelona, one of the big slogans of the Indignados was to say to the governments, don't forget, we are your bosses because we elect you. And indeed, what is the situation of governments, of Western governments today? They're caught between two types of shareholders. On the one hand, the financial markets who pay their bills by lending them money. And on the other hand, the voters who elect them to power. And so what they have to do is to arbitrate between these two types of shareholders. However, there's a major difference between the two, is that the voters express themselves once every 4 or 5 years, whereas the financial market express themselves every second. So what should be an arbitration between the two shareholders becomes only an adaptation of what the people want to what the market wants. So the only way to change that is for the people who are not the shareholders to have more influence on what creates value, on what gives credit. And that's why there was a huge lost opportunity when, unfortunately, the Greek government renounced the referendum. Because that was a way of going on the financial market and changing what the value is.
Iceland, the country that said no.
There's one country in Europe that does relatively well, and that country is Iceland. And why does Iceland do well? Because in 2009, as you know, Iceland was one of the countries that was the most hit by the crisis. Basically, the country collapsed because it was like the ultimate neoliberal country. And then they realized the damage, and they realized how the bank had screwed them. And so, because the country was bankrupt, because first of all, the bank was bankrupt, and so that created huge debt. And so, as usual, the debt was socialized. So the people, the Icelandic people were asked to pay for the debts that had been created by the banks. The president of Iceland had this brilliant idea of saying, okay, well, maybe we'll pay the debts, but first, you know, since it's the people who are going to pay this debt, we should ask them. And so he decided, well, let's have a referendum about whether we should pay back this debt. And 95% of the people said, no, we shouldn't. The banks had promised, if you're going to do that, if you say no, you'll see there'll be horrible consequences. But in fact, there were no horrible consequences because the lenders depend on the will of the borrowers to actually pay their debt. And if they don't pay their debt, it would be so damaging for the lenders that they prefer to renegotiate better terms, which they did. So they came back with better terms in 2010 and said, okay, now you're going to pay under these terms. And the president again said, well, let's have a referendum first. And they said no again, this time at 65%. And then again, the banks renegotiated. Now, what is the result of that? The result of that is that, as you know, all the countries that were also much hit by the crisis, like Spain, like Italy, like Greece, in order to do good, made these huge austerity plans, basically destroying their country in order to please the markets. However, these countries have their rating by the rating agencies decreased every 6 months, despite their efforts at killing themselves. Iceland, on the other hand, has kept the same rating at Moody's and Standard & Poor's since 2009. So, in fact, the way to deal with these things is to change the condition under which credit is allocated. And that you can do only if you let people go on the market. So the question is not obeying the market or refusing the market. It's to go on the market and change the condition under which credit is allocated.
Dependent powers.
That's why it is remarkable. I mean, the situation of Iceland that I just described, in a way, everybody knows about it. But it's never written about. And it's never written about for a very good reason. The people in power and the banks don't want people to know that there is an option and that this option would change everything. They don't want to know that, contrary to what is said, the financial markets are only powerful because they have people who obey. And at the very moment people stop obeying, they have no power. I mean, these markets don't produce anything. All they have is money. And money that is not theirs, money that comes from savings of people who actually work. But nonetheless, they have this money that they can distribute the way they want. But that's all they have. So they're much more dependent on their borrowers, who actually produce real things, than the borrowers are dependent on the markets if they realize that the leverage can be different if you have the courage to say no.
Democratic measures against the oppression of financial markets.
And that needs kind of this pressure, this democratic pressure that has to happen on these financial markets. So that means what? That means all kinds of measures. I mean, one measure are these referendums. Another measure would be to create alternative rating agencies. Rating agencies that would work exactly in the way Moody's and Standard & Poor's work, except that their criterions would be the social, the ecological, the democratic condition under which production is made. And they would give ratings. So first you would say, well, why would investor care? Well, in fact, they do care. They do care because investors usually are only moved by enthusiasm and fear. And it's very easy to instill fear in them. If you start publicizing the fact that, you know, there's a rotten mode of production in that company that would lead to terrible product, or that there's a financial scam happening that can really destroy this company in the next 6 months. If you give enough money to these agencies that will, you know, give their opinions, but on different criterion, again, different forms of credit than the rating agencies, that can really alter the moods, the fears, and the enthusiasm of investors. So that's one measure. These referendums on how we should deal with the debt are a second measure. A third measure would be to actually create large funds, but that would invest according to the criteriums of these alternative rating agencies rather than the criterion of the existing rating agencies. And these funds would come from unions, would come from NGOs, would come from local collectivities and even states. And they would speculate in a way. But they would speculate for exactly the opposite values as what the speculative funds are speculating. That, it seems to me, is carrying out the fight. And it's a relatively moderate fight in a way. I mean, it's the same. It's the equivalent of what social democracy and the labor movement was at the time when the labor market was the important market. Now it's the financial market that matters, and so the same kind of organization have to take hold and operate on the financial market.
Set François. you can change it.
Cette France-là is this France, is a collective that was created during the presidential campaign in France in 2007. And we started off with posters that we printed and that we put all over France. There were more than 15,000 of them. And it was to protest the policy of immigration, the immigration policy that was already carried out under Sarkozy as the Minister of the Interior, and that was going to get worse with Sarkozy becoming president. And so it was six different posters, each representing one undocumented migrant who had been expelled from France. And so we had his or her photo, we had the story of his or her encounter with the French administration, and the running slogan was, "This France, cette France-là, do you like it?" And then underneath, you can change it. Well, the election was won by Sarkozy despite our beautiful campaign, so we decided, we asked ourselves, what are we going to do now? And so we decided to do this book, yearly book, following the French immigration policy step by step. And the book is made of four parts. The first part are portraits of undocumented migrants and their story, whether they've been expelled, whether in fact they finally got papers, or whether they're still in limbo, which is the case of a lot of them. The second part was a description of how this policy works, from the presidential project to what was called then the Ministry of Immigration that has now disappeared, to the préfecture, meaning the local administration, which are really the ones carrying out the policy, the others, ministerial agency, and so forth. The third part was another series of portraits, but this time not portraits of undocumented migrants, but portraits of préfets. I don't know what the equivalent in Spain of the préfets are. France is divided into districts, and they are the representative of the central government in that very district. And so they're the one in charge of the police and immigration policy of that district. And one of the major moves of Sarkozy was to give more power to the préfet and less possibility of control of their work. That is the fundamental undemocratization, de-democratization of neoliberal states, is to give executive privilege. It's to give as much as possible privileges to the executive branch and no possibility of control. And that's what Sarkozy did, especially with the policy of immigration. So we thought, since these people have all this power, we should see how they exercise their power. And so we have portraits with their photo and their record. And then the fourth part was an essay on what is the rationale of this policy. And so, because the point was not only to be indignado, not only to say this is disgusting, but to say, on the one hand, this is disgusting, but on the other hand, it's totally irrational. Even if you wanted to be crass utilitarian and say, well, what's good is what's good for the economy of France, this would be a completely ridiculous policy. So it was to show both the cruelty and the absurdity of this policy.
Cette France-là, editorial activism.
We were lucky enough to have very good media coverage. And also, we distributed them to all possible politicians, meaning members of parliament, of course, the government, and so forth. And so we started this kind of lobbying work, and especially we started lobbying with the opposition party. And in fact, with the second volume, we managed to convince about 30 members of parliament, Senate, and European parliament, of all parties, there were even two or three dissidents from Sarkozy's party, to do the same thing we do. In other words, to carry out an audit of the immigration policy of the government. So we had at the National Assembly, where we organized these sessions where economists, sociologists, but also members of the administration, lawyers, judges came and presented this ridiculous policy and critiqued this ridiculous policy. And then we published this audit as. So it's that kind of lobbying that we're doing and that we're trying to do.
Sarkozy's government and the imaginary invasion.
Sarkozy's government, and Sarkozy in particular, is presenting himself as the protector of France. So what is he going to protect? First, he was going to protect the purchase power of the French people and protect them against unemployment, but that didn't happen. Then he was going to protect the AAA in the ratings, but that seems to be crumbling. So the only thing that he can protect France from is an imaginary invasion of foreigners coming from the south. And so xenophobia has become a very important part of his policy just because that's all he has to offer. He has no good news to deliver on anything else, so xenophobia is there as the only thing that I can protect you from are foreigners who are not there and who don't intend to come for the most part. And those who come here, in fact, are very helpful. But the problem is that the less other good news he has to offer, the more he has to insist on xenophobia. And so we have really frightening evolution of the policy. In the beginning of his presidency in 2007-2008, the policy was already disgusting, but it was in the name of creating a more selective and a more prone to integration kind of immigration. In fact, it seems to be tough what we're doing, but we're doing for a good cause, which is to make for a better feelings between French people and immigrants. At this point, there's no attempt to try to cover up this policy in some kind of lofty ideals. It's just French people don't feel at home, we need to protect them, so we need to reduce immigration, period. So it's becoming very crude, it's becoming very, very ugly, ugly in practice, but now even extremely ugly in discourse. So we have to continue that kind of work.
Zone Books, an independent publishing house.
I'm from Belgium originally, and then from then I went to New York and I studied there, and then came to France after that. But while I was in New York, I mean, with friends, we decided to start a journal after we finished our studies. And that journal was called Zone. The problem was that the first issue of that journal, which was on notion of contemporary city, that came out a long time ago, I'm an old man, came out in 1986. The problem is that it took us about a year and a half to produce that journal, and it was about 500 pages long, so we realized this is not a journal. And so we continued, we did several issues, but every year, every other year, and then we stopped, and then we became a publishing house. And so Zone Books has been a publishing house since now, 1987, 1988. And in the beginning, we published a lot of what was called in America French theory, Foucault, Deleuze, and all these people. And so we published a lot of that, translated and published that, but then we became a real American publishing house, and we've been that ever since the 80s and the 90s. And so we developed, we're now three editors, and so according to our specialty, we developed different areas of specialty. We have a remarkable art historian among us who's Jonathan Crary. So thanks to him, we have a great series of books on art history. And again, we specialized in the intersection between art history and history of science. People like Galison, Daston, Lorraine Daston, Catherine Park are some of our main authors there. We continue to publish French things. We publish also Agamben and other people. And so there's the development of that, but also with the book that you mentioned earlier, Non-Governmental Politics, which I edited, we wanted to become more obviously political too. So we've published a series of books of that sort. But now the idea is to develop specific areas. And in fact, we've done one book that came out a few months ago, which is on intellectual property and sort of the activism against intellectual property and for access to knowledge. So we developed that. We'll have another one that will come next year, which might be particularly interesting for museums, which will be about the visual culture of non-governmental politics. In other words, how artists are investing this realm of non-governmental politics and how do both artworks, performances work with that kind of non-governmental politics. So that's the evolution of Zone Books. But at this point, Zone Books is a publishing house that does both academic work, more political work, but it's a small publishing house. We're publishing about 5 books per year, but it's going on and it's going well.
Makba.cat.